You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Most of Exodus chapter 15 is a song. God has delivered his people in this miraculous way through the Red Sea. He's delivered them safely, and their response to that is to sing. Right? In unison, as a congregation, their voices go up to praise the one who had saved them, delivered them, liberated them out of slavery. And I imagine that that moment in Exodus 15 was just this thrilling moment of worship where everyone just sensed, you know what, it's great to be a part of the people of God. Right? I don't know if you've ever been in a moment where you just the emotion of the moment, you felt it. You know, you've been at a concert and the band sings a song that's like a crowd favorite and the whole crowd is singing the song with the band. Or if you've been at a football stadium and the entire stadium is singing the school song or the national anthem loudly. Like those are moments where like sometimes the hair will stand up on your arm. You're just like, man, it's great to be a part of this moment. There's something about unified singing, corporate singing, voices raised together in joy. But the narrative goes on into chapter 16, and pretty quickly there's a transition away from singing. In Exodus 16, we don't see corporate singing anymore. We actually see corporate grumbling, right? Corporate complaining. Like pretty quickly they go from worship to whining. Right? They were singing on Sunday at church, and now it's Monday in the office, and they're complaining. I don't know if you can relate to that. Sometimes I don't quite make it to Monday before I start the grumbling. The book of Exodus is essentially about salvation, right? It's about the total liberation of a people from that which enslaves them. And once that people has been liberated, the question is, how do they live as free people? What is that freedom supposed to look like in their daily lives? See, the Israelites had been freed from the tyranny of Egypt, but they had not yet been freed from the tyranny of themselves. And they have to be freed from that. And so their departure from Egypt, we might think of as like their birth into salvation. But now they're infants. Now they got to learn to walk. Now they got to learn to trust. Now they need to grow up in their salvation. And so to do that, God takes them on this journey. And it's a journey that mirrors the pattern of the Christian life, which is why we have so much to glean from the book of Exodus. I want you to see where God leads them first in this journey. Look at chapter 16 of Exodus, verse 1. It says, they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So God leads them, but he leads them somewhere very specific. He leads them into the wilderness. He leads them into the desert. He leads them into a place that's uninhabitable because there's not a lot of food there, there's not much water there, the elements are brutal, but that's where he leads them. He's not leading the Israelites on the most direct route to the promised land. If you looked at a map, the way they need to be going is due east to get to Canaan, the promised land. He takes them south, south into the desert, into the wilderness. And there in the wilderness, that's where they're going to learn to walk with God. That's where they're going to learn to trust God because they've seen God do the extraordinary, but they don't yet know how to trust God in the ordinary of their daily life. They'd seen God save them, but they had this nagging question, yeah, God saved us, but will God provide for us? Will God take care of us? And so let's look at what happens in chapter 16. We're going to look at first God's people, then God's provision, and then God's point. Okay, so the people, the provision, the point. Let's start by looking at the people here in this story. As chapter 16 begins, it's basically been a little over a month since they came out of slavery in Egypt. Just a little over a month. And they're not doing so well. Right? This is not a good portrait of the people of God as chapter 16 begins. Look at verse 2 and 3. It says, and the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For Moses and Aaron, you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So as it starts out, the whole congregation it's a unified grumbling. It's not just a few bad apples, not just a few cranky people. They're all grumbling. They're all complaining. And the word grumble has a certain onomatopoeia to it, doesn't it? It sounds like what it is. It's like grumble, 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 grumble. Because that's what grumbling is. It's just this low-level murmuring. It's this low-level complaining that has a way of just sort of bubbling up to the surface and spreading. It's a form of immaturity, and that's exactly what Israel is. They're immature. They've just been birthed into salvation, and they're like little kids learning how to walk. Now, a couple of observations about the content of their grumbling. You see the content of their grumbling in verse 3. Just a couple of thoughts about it. Number one, they exaggerate the glories of their previous situation. They're like, remember how great it was back in Egypt? Like, it was like all you can eat all the time. You know, we sit around, just gorge ourselves on meat and bread, and it was like Thanksgiving every day. And they're like, oh, Pharaoh takes such good care of us. Right? Those are the good old days. They just exaggerate their previous situation. The second thing they do is they misrepresent their current situation. They're like, Moses, we are literally starving out here. We are about to die of hunger, which is not true. As you read on in chapter 17, you're going to see they have all their livestock with them still. So they have milk available to them. They can make cheese. They can throw a steak on the grill, I guess, you know, if they wanted to. There's food available. Psalm 78 says, the Israelites tested God in the desert by demanding the food that they craved. So it's not that they didn't have any food. It's just that they were craving a certain type of food. And so they grumbled and they misrepresented their current situation. Tim Keller makes the observation that this language in verse 3 kind of sounds like the language of addiction, right? Because there's delusion. Man, wasn't Egypt great? There's denial. Man, we don't have any food anywhere. There's blame. Moses and Aaron, it's all your fault. There's this sense that they are being driven by their appetites and desires to the point that that's all they can think about. They're still enslaved in some sense, right? Which lets us know that it was pretty quick and easy to get them out of Egypt. It's going to take a long time to get Egypt out of them because what's in them is now coming out. Grumbling is just revealing what's in them. They are still addicted, right? They're still enslaved in some ways to their own self-centeredness. I want my needs, my appetites, my wants, my desires fulfilled right now. Now, circumstances are not the root cause of grumbling. Right? Grumbling is something that actually comes up out of the heart. Circumstances just squeeze us sometimes and reveal what's in us. This is what's so great about the desert, about the wilderness. It's this really uncomfortable place that squeezes us and begins to reveal what's in us. And grumbling, a grumbling heart or a complaining spirit, I think is holding on to some core beliefs that are false beliefs. And they're beliefs like this. I deserve this. I've earned this. I'm entitled to this. I want this, therefore I need this. I'm tired of waiting. I did not expect things to work out like this. If I was in charge, things would be a lot better. If I don't take care of myself, then nobody's going to take care of me. And beliefs like this begin to bubble to the surface, and then it's just like grumble, 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 grumble. If you think about it, we live in, a culture that where grumbling and complaining are kind of the way of life, so much to the point where we don't even realize it. We're kind of numb to it. It's just the air that we breathe. It's around us everywhere, grumbling, whining, complaining. A few years ago, Amy and I like to go back and watch this clip every once in a while. There was a comedian that was on the Conan O'Brien show, and he was being interviewed, Louis C.K., and it's like a four-minute clip of him being interviewed, and he's talking about our culture and how whiny and complaining our culture is. And his line was, everything's amazing right now, and nobody's happy, right? And he's talking about how amazing technology is today and how it's being wasted on sort of a whiny, complainy generation, which is us. And he tells a story about how he was on a plane recently, and they were just revealing that day on the flight the newest thing out there on a flight, and it was high-speed internet on the plane, Wi-Fi on the plane. And they're like, they took off, and they're like, they come on, they're like, hey, open up your laptops. You can, you know, we got Wi-Fi now. And everybody's like, you know, he's like, I'm doing internet, I'm checking email, I'm watching YouTube. This is great. Well, it goes down, the internet goes down a few minutes into the flight, and they come on the last figure, and they're like, sorry, the internet's not working. And the guy next to him is like, it's ridiculous. And he goes, how quickly does the world owe this guy something that he only knew existed like 10 seconds ago? And that's the heart of grumbling, isn't it? The world owes me something. And the larger problem for us as Christians is that when we grumble, we're ultimately directing our complaints at God, and God hears them. Look at verse 7. Verse 7. And in the morning, Moses says, you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we, said Moses, that you grumble against us? See, their grumbling is directed at God. It's against him. They think they're grumbling against Moses, but they're grumbling against God, and he hears them. Four times in this chapter it says he hears them. He's listening. So their grumbling is rebellion against God. It's distrust of God. God, you brought us out here to kill us. I mean, how ridiculous is that thought? Why would God go through all that we've done so far to take them out so they would starve to death? God, you're doing it wrong. God, this is not what I expected. God, you owe me something. And so grumbling has a way of, and a grumbling heart has a way of crying out to God, but not because it trusts God. Like, a grumbling heart cries out to God because it distrusts God. A grumbling heart doesn't cry out and say, God, I need you. A grumbling heart cries out and says, God, you've failed me. You've let me down. So let me ask all of us this. What do you find yourself complaining about? And be honest. And the next question is, what's below the surface of those complaints? And you might need to take some devotional time, honestly, to think about this. What am I believing below the surface about myself, about God, about how life is supposed to work? Are there expectations that I'm holding on to? When we grumble about our circumstances, when we grumble about our job, when we grumble about our relationships, when we grumble about our spiritual leaders, when we grumble about anything, we're actually grumbling against God, and we're saying, God, you have not provided for me in a way that I expected, or you're providing in a way that I don't like. And most of us, I think, as Christians, don't doubt that God will save us in an ultimate sense. But sometimes we struggle that God will provide for us in the way that we think he should, and so we grumble in our daily lives. But God responds to the grumbling in the story, and he responds with a provision. It's a gracious provision. And so we have a grumbling people answered by a gracious provision. Right? That's the surprising thing. The amazing thing is that God doesn't punish the people for their grumbling. He actually provides for them in spite of their grumbling, which teaches us something about the gospel, doesn't it? It tells us that God gives to us out of his faithfulness, not because of our faithfulness. Right? God takes care of his children just because they're his children, not because they're always on their best behavior. It's grace. Look at the provision in verse 11. Exodus 16, verse 11. And the Lord said to Moses, I've heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And in the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. And when the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? Literally, they said, manhu, which this is why they call it manna. What is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it's the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. And so the Lord provides here quail, and then bread or manna for them. We're just going to spend a few minutes focusing on the bread today because the quail was actually something that happened rarely. It happened here and one other time, but the bread was going to be this ongoing daily provision for the next 40 years. And so I just want to make a few observations about the provision of manna here or bread. And the first is that God's provision was abundant. It was abundant. Look at verse 12. At the end of verse 12, it says, "In the morning you shall be filled with bread." And that word filled is the same word the Israelites used when they were reminiscing in verse 3 about Egypt, when they talked about being so full. It just means to be full, so satisfied that you're pushing back from the table like, I couldn't eat another bite. Right? They're filled with bread. And another way that God says it in verse 4 is he says, I'm about to rain bread from heaven on you. Right? What an image that is. Like, not just a little bit of bread, it's going to be raining bread out there. I'm going to pour down bread on you, which speaks to the grace of God, doesn't it? Because do you want to rain down good gifts on a bunch of grumblers? If someone's complaining against you, do you want to shower them with good things? I'd be like, here's a stale roll or something, right? Stop your whining. And yet God doesn't, he doesn't do it in a minimal way. It's abundant. He says, I'm going to fill you up with bread. The provision is also unexplainable. Look at verse 15. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It's the bread the Lord has given you to eat." They could not account for this. They'd never seen anything like it before because somehow God was providing food for them in a foodless place. Right? God was giving them bread in a place where there should be no bread. They just woke up in the morning and voila, there it was. They didn't know I'd got there. It was just there. Now, this is actually not that much different than your experience and my experience, is it? I mean, I get up every morning and I make myself 2 eggs over easy. Okay? I open my fridge and voila, there is a carton of eggs in my refrigerator. And I have no idea how they got there. Right? I mean, I know that they came from a chicken somewhere down the line. And I had nothing to do with that, but I opened my fridge and they're just there. And you say, well, that's not really like the manna because you bought those eggs at HEB. You know where you got them. You bought them with money from your checking account up at HEB. Every 2 weeks, I look at my checking account and voila, there's new money in there. It's a paycheck from Providence Church. So I should say thank you to some of you. I have no idea how it got there. It's just there. It's there. And you're like, oh, you know, it was wired there. I'm like, well, there's maybe 2 of you in the room that can explain how that works. Here's what I want you to catch. That is not my provision for myself, right? That's God's provision for me, and it's no less God's provision than the manna in Exodus 16, and I should never be at a point where I'm not in awe of the unexplainability of it. Because then I'd start taking it for granted. It's unexplainable. God's provision is also a foretaste. Look at verse 31. This is cool. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Meaning, apparently manna tasted good. It tasted like honey. Now, God didn't have to do that. He could have made it just nasty. Right? He could have made it bland. But he made it taste sweet like honey because where is God leading them on this journey? Like, what is their final destination? A land flowing with milk and honey. And God was saying with the manna, he was saying, hey, you're not there yet, but this daily provision for you is a little foretaste of what it's going to be like when you get there. And God's daily provision for us is the same way. What he does for you and for me, it's the same thing. It's a foretaste. And so every good meal that we eat, like every bowl of ice cream, every glass of wine, every warm blanket, every deep conversation with a friend, every belly laugh, those are just a foretaste. They're not the destination, but they taste like it. And God is saying in those things, hey, you're not there yet, but where I'm taking you is going to be sweet. It's a foretaste. And the last thing about his provision that we see here is that it's for his glory. Meaning, his provision is for the weight of his own reputation. Look at verse 6. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was Yahweh, it was the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of Yahweh," the glory of the Lord. What will the glory of Yahweh look like in the morning? It'll look like manna all over the ground. That's what his glory will look like. And God is saying, in my provision of food, I want you to know that I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt. I am the glorious one. I am the famous one. It's the weight of his reputation at stake here. See, only God can save his people, and only God can provide for his people, and there is glory in his provision. Philip Ryken says, there's glory in the ordinary providence of God, the providence of God. God taking care of us. There's glory. There's weightiness in that because only he can do it. Only the God who saves us can actually sustain us, and to him be the glory. Now, in light of this provision, you know one of the greatest ways I think there is to combat a grumbling heart, a complaining spirit? I think it's just to cultivate thankfulness. And I mean in the little things, cultivating thankfulness. This is why we stop and we pause and we pray before we eat. We don't pause to bless the food, to ask God to give it some kind of supernatural power to help strengthen us, right? The food already has everything in it that it needs to strengthen us. We don't bless the food, we bless God. We thank God. So every meal should remind us that God is real, that God really is there, that he really cares, that he really knows your longings, he really knows your needs, he really delights to provide for you. The more we thank him for his providence, the harder it'll be to grumble. The harder it'll be to complain. All right. We've looked at the people. They were grumbling. We've looked at the provision. It was gracious. Now I want to end by looking at the point. What's the point? In other words, why did God do it this way with the whole manna thing? Did he have a larger point in mind? Was God's only point and purpose to feed the people? Like fatten them up a little bit so they stop their whining, they wouldn't be hungry anymore. Is that the point? Tim Keller has asked a good question, and he says, and his question is, why didn't God go all the way with the manna miracle? Like, why didn't God just put it right in their stomach? Because he could do that, right? If he can put bread everywhere on the ground, certainly he can just make it a whole lot easier and just put it right in them. So they wake up in the morning, they're like, oh man, I'm starving. Wait. Oh, there it is. Oh, man, I'm stuffed. All right, thanks, God. It'd be a whole lot easier if he had done it that way. But no, he didn't. He did it a very particular way. He made it a daily provision. It's going to be every day. And then he gave very specific instructions about how they had to go out and gather that. They had to participate in the gathering of the provision. They had to be involved in some way. Look at verse 4 and 5. Chapter 16, verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather one day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So on the sixth day, they're going to get twice as much because the seventh day is going to be a day of rest, Sabbath. There's not going to be any bread that day. Get twice as much on the sixth day. All right, skip over to verse 16. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it. Listen how specific he gets here. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer, according to the number of persons that each of you has in his tent. An omer is like a half gallon. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. So it's a communal thing. Everybody's involved. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he or she could eat. And so some people, you know, maybe the little kids didn't gather as much, those that weren't as strong, so, you know, those big strapping high school guys, they were getting more, but they brought it all together, they measured it out, and when they distributed it, everybody had plenty. Verse 19, and Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over till morning." Now, why is that? Why not leave any of it over till morning. Why not just get a little extra? Wrap it up, stick it in the pantry, because maybe you're gonna want a midnight snack later, right? Or maybe you need a big breakfast and you want a little extra. Why not leave any of it over? Well, in verse 4, it says that it was a test to see whether they'd walk in God's law or not. In other words, will they trust God's provision in the way God provides it? Like, will they trust that God has tomorrow taken care of so that they don't have to worry about it? Will they obey God and gather the manna in the way that God says to gather it? And apparently some of them wouldn't. Some of them didn't trust. Look at verse 20. But they did not listen to Moses. Some of them left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. Stank. They didn't trust God, did they, in this instance? They wanted God's provision, but they wanted it on their own terms, and so they tried to self-provide by hoarding, and it just ended up breeding maggots and stinking. And there's a truism here for all of us, right? Whenever we try to provide in our own way, whenever we think we can secure life in our own way, on our own terms, it might work for a little while, but it ends up stinking. It ends up just breeding worms. We think we're hoarding life, but we're hoarding things that lead to death. And so this, according to what it says here, was a test, and they seem to fail the test here. Now, we need to think a little bit differently in our minds about what we think of when we hear test and what God is doing here. When we think about test, we tend to think of exams. We think of like mean old professor that's handing out hard exams because he's trying to weed out the program and get rid of the people who don't qualify, and the people that get Fs, they're out, right? Psh, they're out. That's not what God means by test here, because God is not the professor of his people. God is the father of his people. And when it says he's testing them here, it means he's teaching his children. He's training his children. You know, a dad that's, Kendall mentioned this last week, trying to teach their little girl to walk. A dad that's teaching a little girl or a little boy to walk, if they fall down, the dad doesn't raise his hand. I knew you couldn't do it. Right? What do? They pick them up and they say, no, let's try this again. I'm going to give you a little test, little thing. It's going to be like 6 inches, right? Just walk from me to mommy. Okay, and I fall down. Oh, let's try it again. See how that works? They're just teaching. They're just training their children. How do we know? When God is testing them here, he is teaching them. He's not trying to fail them. How do we know that? Because they fail here, and the manna keeps coming. And actually, it's going to keep coming and coming and coming every day for 40 years, despite their unfaithfulness. God is providing for them. So God, in the way he does the manna miracle, he's not just feeding his people, he's forming them. He's trying to form them into a very particular type of people, the type of people who trust him daily as their daily bread, right? The type of people who want to walk with him in daily dependence upon him. God did not bring them out of Egypt so that they could just be an independent, autonomous people. He brought them out of Egypt so that they could be a dependent people, dependent on him. And in the manna miracle, the way he's doing it, he's sanctifying them, he's growing them, and he's allowing them actually to participate in their own sanctification. It's very cool. And this is why God did the manna miracle the way that he did it. He wants them to know that they don't just need bread, they need him. That's the point. It's the point of why he did it that way. In fact, Moses tells us this 40 years later. Just listen to this. This is cool. From Deuteronomy chapter 8. He tells us that this was the point of the manna. He says, "And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you, and he let you hunger, and he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know." Why? "That he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord." So see, the manna miracle pointed to something much greater. So God used the physical pain of hunger to point to a much greater spiritual reality. They didn't just need bread, they needed God. And wherever God is, that's where life is. Right? Even in the wilderness, even in a lifeless place, if God is there, life is there. If God's not there, it's not real life. They needed more than bread. They needed to say to God, "You're my daily bread." Jesus actually made this point in John chapter 6. If you remember the story in John 6, Jesus had fed, it was out kind of in the wilderness, out away from town, and he had fed like 5,000 people. And then the next day, they come looking for him because they're hungry again. And they're like, "Let's go find that guy that gave us lunch yesterday because that was really good." And so they're trying to chase Jesus down for some more lunch. And this is what Jesus says to them in John 6, verse 26. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you're seeking me, you're looking for me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves." You want some more bread. He says, "Do not work for the food that perishes or spoils or gets maggots in it. Work for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you." Skip down to verse 30. So they said to him, "Well, then what sign do you do that we may believe you? What work do you perform? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, 'He gave them bread from heaven to eat.'" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, it wasn't Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And they said to him, "Sir, give us that bread. Always. We want that bread you're talking about." And Jesus said to him, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes shall never thirst." And what Jesus was saying is, "I'm the bread of life. I'm the fulfillment of the manna miracle. I am the answer to all your hungers." And you know what most of the crowd does when he says that? Verse 41, they grumbled. They grumbled about him because he said, "I'm the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, 'I'm the bread who came down from heaven'?" They're like, "How can this guy be bread from heaven? There's nothing impressive about him. He is not what we were expecting." And grumble, 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 grumble. How can he be our daily provision? So let me ask you, do you believe that Jesus is the bread of life? Like, do you believe that Jesus is God's eternal provision for you? That he is the only manna that will truly give you life? And if you do believe that, what would it look like for you to trust him as your daily bread? Like, what would it look like for you to say to Jesus, "Jesus, I have you, and that's enough. Like, I don't have whatever it is, fill in the blank, in your life right now, but I have you, and that's enough. You fill me up." What would it take to trust him in that way? I want to move us to the communion table, because I think communion is an obvious tie-in here. It's a weekly testimony of our belief that only Jesus can fill us up, right? That only Jesus can give us life. Communion not only reminds us of this, it actually forms us to be the kind of people that keep believing that and keep trying to live in such a way that we depend on him as our daily bread. As we set up the communion table, let me just read a few more verses from John chapter 6, starting in verse 48. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. But this is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." And the crowd then disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." In other words, to truly live, we've got to take Jesus into ourselves by faith. Like, to truly live and to truly nourish ourselves, we've got to take him in. We've got to feed on him and nourish ourselves in him that we might live forever. Communion has a way of telling us exactly how he gave his flesh as bread for the life of the world. The exact way that he did that is he died for us, and this is why we each week tell the same story. That on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread, and after giving thanks for it, he broke it and he passed it out and he said, this is my body given for you. This is manna from heaven. This is me for you, for the life of the world. In the same way, he took a cup of wine and he passed it around and he said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. This is God's provision for you for the forgiveness of your sins. This is the way that God has decided to provide. Will you receive it? Let me thank the Lord for these things.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.